KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition, indeed the inaugural fall quarter edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on this inaugural fall quarter show of Hearsay Culture. Today I'm very excited to have on the authors of a very challenging and I think somewhat controversial, at the same the least, book. The authors are McKelly Boldrin and David K. Levine, no relation, both professors at Washington University in St. Louis, and they have co-authored the book titled very directly, Against Intellectual Monopoly. And to the extent that you were looking for any ambiguity, even beyond that title, the cover of the book has the famous copyright symbol with Against Intellectual Monopoly straight through the symbol itself. So I think it's pretty clear where the authors come from. But putting aside that very challenging and I think eye-catching title is a very interesting and detailed empirical analysis of both copyright and patent law. And what both McKelly and David approach this issue from the standpoint not as lawyers but as economists. And I'm always excited to have economists on Hearsay Culture as someone who has a training in economics to the extent that you could call taking several courses in undergrad a training in economics. I've always wanted to know more, and I've attempted to learn more, and when I have economists on the show, I'm excited because I always know that I'm going to learn a lot, and I think from this book, I learned a great deal. McKelly and David take the position, basically, that both the copyright and patent system, at the end of the day, are not doing their design job, which they argue, of course, is to spur innovation. And this is not just a conclusion that they reach and state and then move on based upon theory, but they also look at empirical data and analyze the empirical data to support their arguments. They take on copyright and patent because those certainly are two areas where there is a wide-ranging level of opinion in terms of what it's doing and how it's operating. But they also do mention trademark and trade secrecy as other avenues, at least of exploration, in terms of redundancies and other types of issues with regard to intellectual property. So we have quite a bit of ground to cover on today's show, and while we certainly will only be able to get to the tip of the iceberg, I am very much looking forward to discussing these issues with McKelly and David. We've had a number of guests on the show who take a dim view of copyright and or patent law, and in fact, we will discuss, I think, briefly the work of Mike Moore and Jim Besson, who recently authored Patent Failure, Mike having been on the show about a month ago discussing patent failure and kind of get their take on some of the current work being done in this area. By very brief introduction, and allow them to talk about their backgrounds in more detail, McKelly Boldrin is the Joseph G. Hoyt Distinguished Professor of Economics in Arts and Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. He's also a fellow of the Econometric Society and a research fellow at the Center for Economic Policy Research in London, and at the Fundación de Estudios de Economía Aplicada in Madrid. I hope I did that justice. He's published in a wide variety of economic journals. His research interests include growth, innovation, and business cycles, intergenerational and demographical issues, public policy, institutions, and social norms. David K. Levine, again, no relation, but I'm certainly biased towards the name, is the John H. Biggs Distinguished Professor of Economics and Arts and Sciences, also at Washington University in St. Louis. He's co-editor of Econometrica and NAJ Economics. He's president of Society for Economic Dynamics, a fellow of the Econometric Society, and a research associate of the National Bureau for Economic Research. And again, both McKelly and David have lengthy publication credits in a variety of journals. And with that introduction, I'm very excited to welcome McKelly and David to the show. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, gentlemen.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you.
Let's dive right in. And what I like to ask authors, particularly, is a little bit more about your background and how you got interested in focusing on these issues.
Well, do you want me to answer first, then McKelly can contradict my story?
Sounds good. Sounds good, David.
We started into this because we were interested in really not particularly in copyrights and patents or trademarks or anything like that. We entered into this because we're interested, as a lot of economists are, in growth and innovation and why some countries are rich and why some countries are getting richer and why some countries are poor and other countries are getting poorer. And we entered this really as theorists. There's a variety of theories of growth and innovation around, and we were interested in expanding on some of those theories. And it was really in the process of doing that, it's sort of a built-in fact of most economic theories that patents and copyrights serve a useful purpose in encouraging growth and innovation. And we discovered, just as theorists, that there were some flaws in this theory, that really these kinds of monopolies aren't at all necessary in order to encourage growth and innovation from a theoretical perspective. That didn't lead us to any strong conclusion, but it made us wonder what was really going on. It led us to look at data. It led us to look at the empirical research. And as we did that, we discovered that there really didn't seem to be much of a role for patents and copyright in the process of growth and innovation. And that has led us ultimately to think that they're probably a pretty poor idea.
Sure. Go ahead, McKelly.
I cannot predict. I am trying hard. I don't know. I can tell you the personal things. We talked about it since we have known each other. We happen to know each other at the time that the so-called new growth theory that says everything good comes from monopoly started to roar. That was the middle 80s, like 86, 87. Complained about it privately between the two of us for about 10, 12 years. As far as I was concerned, I would have gone on with that for the rest of my days. I thought that we were right, and it was a lot of fun. David being more practical, said, I'm sick and tired of this. It's boring. We're agreeing on everything. Either we write a paper, we move on to another topic the next decade. So we wrote a paper, and the rest is what he said.
The book itself, and we can kind of address it this way, I introduced you, and of course you are economists, and a lot of people that aren't familiar with economics in detail might be intimidated by the idea that two economists have written this book. But it seems in reading it that, my question for you is your target audience, because I found a book eminently readable, even though you get into a very high level of detail with respect to the economic theories here. Who are your target audience? Do you have particular readers in mind?
I think the average educated person is the person that we'd like to reach. So our expertise is, of course, in writing technical articles and technical journals for technical people. That wasn't the target we wanted to reach with this particular book. We really wanted to be able to reach out to everybody, anybody that might vote, anybody that might be concerned about these issues.
The title of the book obviously is quite provocative, and it's a fairly direct and blunt title, but I do want to ask you what exactly you mean by against intellectual monopoly, because you're not talking about intellectual property, you're referring particularly to the phrase intellectual monopoly. So perhaps we could start off by saying, what do you mean by intellectual monopoly, and what does the title, what are you trying to convey directly by this title?
Well, let me try that one. In fact, we debated between calling it against intellectual property and against intellectual monopoly. In the sense of the way in which intellectual
property... The other title is already copyrighted. No, go on. Sorry.
Right. That's true. The way intellectual property is designed these days amounts to defining intellectual monopoly. So that's where the pun, if you want, or the double entendre in the title is. The current system of copyrights and patents, especially as defined by laws in the United States, but not only United States, European ones are now very different, and the same applies to Japan and most of the world, allow people that hold either copyright or patent a form of intellectual monopoly. Then in the case of copyright, it's pretty much eternal. In case of patent, it's less. On ideas, and that's the point of which we are against. We are against. We think that the type of monopoly that intellectual property allows is socially damaging, and we elaborate in the book why we think it's socially damaging. Socially damaging, especially for innovation and growth.
Let me say a little bit more about that. So, I think both of us dislike the word intellectual property. It's a modern term. It's a term that's been invented in really fairly recent years historically. People refer to exclusive rights or monopolies or copyright or patent by name. The idea of intellectual property is, I think, is a propaganda term. It's designed to try to reassure people this is just property. It's like property in houses. It's like property in automobiles. It's like all the other kind of property around us. And, of course, people have confidence in the system of private property. We have confidence in the system of private property. We believe in capitalism and private property. However, intellectual property is very unlike houses, it's very unlike automobiles, it's very unlike all the things that people are familiar with as property, and we think it's a disservice to suggest through the use of this word that it has something in common with those things. And that's one of the reasons why we tried to use the word intellectual monopoly, to emphasize that this isn't property, right, in the sense of an automobile. This is a monopoly in the sense of being able to monopolize all copies of your idea or all copies of your book.
It does lead to a kind of a background question, especially for those that aren't as familiar with economic terms. I mean, the word monopoly is certainly one that's entered the general parlance. But as economists, what is the basic fundamental definition of a monopoly?
Well, in a sense, monopoly is in itself a misleading term. The issue is really one of the extent of competition. The less competition there is, the more monopoly there is. The more competition there is, the less monopoly there is. So when we refer to a monopoly, it's always sort of a statement of magnitude. It's not a statement of this is a monopoly, that isn't a monopoly. Everybody has a certain extent monopoly. Other people have a lesser extent monopoly. The issue here is one of monopoly or absence of competition that's enforced through government power. So particular in the case of patents and copyrights, the lack of competition, the owners of these rights are given the right not to have to compete against their customers. That's the absence of competition that's implicit in copyright and patent law and intellectual property in general.
You focus in the book, gentlemen, on copyright and patent in particular, and I might ask you to answer why. Why did you focus on those two forms of intellectual property, and why did you decide that they were of such concern that a book needed to focus directly on reforming them or changing the systems?
Well, they are by far 97% of what intellectual property is about. The trademark, which is a relatively minor thing, I mean, which way you look at it, it doesn't really have the economic impact that patents and copyright have. And then there are other things such as license agreements and so on that are nevertheless enforceable and make sense only because patents and copyright exist. In fact, we discussed those too. So in some sense, what we discuss is everything that is called that is called intellectual property, but trademark, on which we probably have mildly different views, but in any case, it's not an issue of major economic impact and relevance. No logo notwithstanding, it's not that important. So what we are debating, in fact, is the very same notion of intellectual property as David was arguing before, and the fact that it leads to a huge restriction of competition and creation of monopoly power.
Just to highlight, the other major form of at least of government-enforced intellectual property is in trademark law. And trademarks, at least in principle, are different because trademarks don't really award you a monopoly over anything except perhaps the use of your own name. Now, trademarks are widely abused in practice. That's a different issue. But the economic impact of that is not great compared to that of copyrights and patents. And while we might disagree mildly over trademark, I think we both agree that it's probably a good idea that people, that business firms should be able to identify themselves in a reliable way.
When you talk to intellectual property law people like me, you get some weird monikers, and so you rarely talk to someone who might identify themselves as a trade secret geek. But that's an area that I write in, and I'm curious, again, from your perspective as economist, where do you see trade secrecy fitting into the panoply of rights that we broadly call intellectual property?
There's two elements of trade secrecy, right? Some trade secrecy is enforced through the legal system. So, for example, things like non-disclosure agreements can be written into contracts and so forth and so on. Other elements of trade secrecy are you just keep a secret. And I guess this is an area, this is a complicated area. I mean, our goal in some sense is to keep government out of it as much as possible. And keeping government out of it includes not having the government force contracts, which are collusive contracts, to promote monopolization. So the case of trade secrets becomes delicate. It would be difficult, for example, to operate a firm if every janitor in the firm was entitled to know every secret of the firm and was allowed to go out and spill the beans to anybody for any price. On the other hand, the non-disclosure agreements seem to be widely abused in practice as well. So that, as I say, I'm not sure that we've gone through thoroughly to say where we would draw the line on trade secrets. I think by and large people have the right to keep things secret, and we wouldn't really want to interfere with that. Sometimes the opposite is to try to force them to disclose things.
Right. not to bury the lead, and I think it's useful in a book like this as we get into more of the detail, I'll ask you kind of what you closed the book on, but to start off the conversation that perhaps we can discuss some of the issues and conclusions that get you there. But you propose what I think most people would view as a fairly radical solution to the problems you identify. So perhaps I'll ask you this somewhat backward, but at the top level, what solution or solutions do you advise with respect to copyright and patent at the very basic level, and then we can get into more detail of those proposed solutions as we discuss more substance of the book?
Well, let me try on that one. Well, the problem with that is that we have had copyright and patent for now quite a long time in Anglo-Saxon world for, depending how you start counting, but at least two centuries, and so a lot of our economic and social life, legal contract and arrangement are built up, assuming that there are copyrights and patents. So while it would be nice in principle to say let's abolish them tomorrow, both of them, and run copyright length to 6 months and patent to 2 days, that's really not very practical. So the first set of issues we address is how do you stop, in fact, the rising in the length and strength and spread of copyright and patents, right? Because if you look at what's been going on for the last, say, 10, 15 years, and got a huge impulse with the TRIPS agreement in the mark of WTO, has been an extension and increase in copyright and patent protection that is in the strength of what we call intellectual monopoly. So the first order of business from that point of view is to create the political and social condition, a cultural condition to stop the increase in the length. Then from there, you can look at what the steps of a gradual reform could be. But yes, from our point of view, we think that over time, it's perfectly possible and in fact desirable to build a legislative system that would allow innovation and creation to work and function without pretty much copyright and patents. But the first order of business definitely seems to be the need of stopping the increase in the length of copyright. And I think that that's where, at this point in time, one may want to focus most of the political attention, at least, in trying to argue and prove with theories and facts that extending the length of this monopolistic protection is actually socially damaging, which is what we do in large part of the book. We show that whenever in recent decades we had experience of extension of patent law, increasing the length of copyright, like with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, these not only did not help innovation and creation, it probably hurt it.
I would add to that.
Because there is in a sense a broader goal of the book. So the book, you know, ultimately the bottom line is we think that copyright and patent should be done away with, which is not, as Michele says, to say that we think it should be done away with overnight. And certainly neither of us is practical enough to believe that over the next 2 years it would be possible to achieve anything more than to slow down the current growth of extensions of more and more monopolies. But the point is, in many respects, to try to change the nature of the intellectual debate over the subject. That is, people now act as if the alternatives, the only alternatives, are we can make it work a little bit better or we can make it work a little bit worse. And, of course, we favor making it work a little bit better. But making a basically broken system work a little bit better shouldn't be the long-term goal of policy. And I guess in the back of both of our minds, by way of analogy, we have in mind something like a policy of free trade and tariffs, right? So economists have argued, you know, for many, many years, it's taken many years, I think with a lot of success, have largely convinced countries around the world that tariffs are not a very good idea. I think the intellectual climate in which support for tariffs was thriving is gone now, and I think a lot of that is because economists were willing to take the bull by the horns and say, look, tariffs are not a good idea. It would be a good idea to have lower tariffs. It would be even a better idea not to have tariffs at all. And there's been, over many years, a great deal of success in that. If I was to point an even more dramatic example, would be the debate over slavery, where purely intellectual arguments carried the day against economic self-interest. That is, the people that argue against slavery weren't themselves slaves, and they were arguing against powerful economic interests that benefited from slavery. Now, I don't want to argue that intellectual monopolies as bad as slavery. That would be a little bit silly. But the point is, it is possible over a long period of time to change people's minds and change the nature of the intellectual debate. And in a sense, part of our goal in this book is to start that process, to get people to think, not let's throw out copyrights and patents tomorrow, but let's think seriously about whether we really need them. Do they really accomplish the goals which they're supposed to accomplish? And if not, should perhaps we be thinking of phasing them out over time?
We're talking to Professors McKelly Boldrin and David K. Levine, authors of the book Against Intellectual Monopoly from Cambridge Press. Gentlemen, when we get into the economic underpinnings of copyright and patent, it's surprising always to me how much divergence there is in terms of how people view the economic underpinnings and the actual purpose or goals of intellectual property law broadly. So again, as economists, perhaps I'll ask you, what do you see as the basic rationale or purpose from an economic standpoint for having an intellectual property law system?
Well, clearly known, we wouldn't have written the book otherwise. that's the short question.
Right, right.
Well, let me try to give, then David will add something. Let me try to give you what the average textbook economics and the average course we take and
right.
also took, and let's say our way of thinking. Very honestly, that was our way of thinking. I remember the first time we were actually in Ischia, I think it was 2001. That David came along to me and said, you do understand that one implication of all the theory of innovation, all the models we've been writing, is that intellectual property and copyright and patent don't make much sense. And I said, yeah, well, I do, but, you know, maybe copyright, but I really cannot do without patents. I think they make sense. And there was clearly a prejudice of, you know, 35 years or 40 years, whatever they were. Research and teaching go in that direction. The economists argue that typical economic wisdom, since Schumpeter and Ken Arrow, is that you need to have some monopoly power given to whoever comes up with an idea for first. And again, whatever it means coming up with an idea for first, there's no such a thing, but let's pretend that's the case. Because otherwise, everybody would get hold of the idea immediately at no cost, copy it immediately, and run this guy to the bottom and make him unable to make a buck and make use of his idea. That's the fundamental argument. The fundamental argument says, look, people that come up with good ideas and good inventions spend a lot of time and money to do that. The others can imitate them for free, and if they imitate them for free, then they can compete with them and drive them out of the market. So the poor innovators would always be losing the money, would not be able to profit from their effort. And knowing that, after repeated trials and repeated failure, they will say, forget it, there's no point, I put effort in inventing penicillin because people will copy it. Hey, nevertheless, the guy did invent penicillin and didn't patent, but that's another story. But that's the basic reason you will hear from your average economist of why we need those things.
I think I might have detected a broader question there. So if I understood the question correctly, so economists would say that the purpose of patent, copyright, intellectual monopoly, or property in general, would be to encourage innovation and growth. That is, to get created books, movies, music, whatever, that would not be created if it was not for this instrument of copyright. To get ideas, new machines, new computer programs, so forth and so on, to get these things invented that would not be invented in the absence of the protection of patent. That would be an economist's argument as to why we should have these things. That seems to be the purpose for patent and copyright, which actually doesn't mention them by name, in the U.S. Constitution, which speaks of promoting the progress of the useful arts and science. So in some sense, I think we agree that the writers of the Constitution had kind of the right idea. Now, there are other rationales for copyright and patent. We can discuss those if you'd like as well.
Yeah, and we have a couple of minutes before we take a break. One of the arguments that you hear about intellectual property rights, at least among people that advocate strong copyright in particular, is that what the real goal of intellectual property law is not to spur innovation as much as it is what we might call exacting rents. That the simple idea that an author where a creator has a fundamental right to extract as much value from their invention as possible, and that has nothing to do with innovation. That's a policy issue as much as it is anything else. But from your perspective, does that argument or that kind of argument hold any water?
Well, I guess part of the issue is what it means to have that right. That is, why does the fact that you created it first give you the right to, you know, so I sell my book to you. Why does the fact that I wrote the book and then sold it to you give me the right to tell you automatically what you should do with the book? And that's really what's at issue with copyright. So I don't think there's any dispute that people that have ideas have the right to do what they please with those ideas, employ those ideas the way they want, sell those ideas as they wish to. The question is, to what extent are they allowed to impose downstream restrictions on the people who get the ideas from them? Because I invented an idea, am I now entitled to tell people that they can use the idea only in particular ways? I don't understand why that should be a natural right of a author or a creator or an inventor. So from that perspective, I don't really understand the argument. From the perspective of, gee, because I had a good idea, I'm required to tell it to people, or I'm required to use it in a particular way, I wouldn't agree with that either. So I think people should be allowed to extract rents from their ideas. I just don't think they should be allowed to impose restrictions on other people in order to be able to extract those rents.
Well, let me try to put it another way, because people may use the analogy between an idea and any other object. It says, well, you know, you produce coffee, you make coffee, you produce chairs, you sell chairs, why you're not allowed to extract rents and from ideas by preventing other people from stealing them when you're instead allowed to do that in the case of coffee and chairs? The problem with ideas is the people that imitate you, even assuming that they're really imitating you, that they learn it from you, they pay to you a service fee for teaching them the thing or the idea was involved in whatever they bought from you, they're not stealing your idea. When I take away the chair you're trying to sell in one way or another, I appropriate it, and I sell it myself, that's what we have in mind when we say stealing, right? You no longer have the chair. That chair is, in the parlance of the economist, a rivalrous thing. It's either you have it or I have it. Either you sell it or I sell it. Mm-hmm. Stealing there has a very well-defined sense, and even from a philosophical point of view, we understand quite clearly what it means to have a natural right to own the chair you produce. But when it comes to the idea that I've learned from you, that I go out and use it and possibly, as it happens most of the time, improve upon it, I haven't stolen your idea at all. You still have your ideas exactly like you had it the moment before. You might even have a better version of that because in trying to explain it to me, it got clearer in your mind, but doesn't matter. I'm just not stealing your idea. You still own your copy of the idea. Mm-hmm. The basic, if you want, one can think very philosophical or abstract or general point we try to make is that there is a dramatic difference between material objects that are rivals like land or coffee or chairs and this thing called ideas. And this goes back to the thing that David was mentioning earlier on when you asked us what about intellectual property, right? That the use of the word property, it's true, plays a rhetorical role in this argument. It's meant to capture the audience and convince the audience that ideas are like cups of coffee, but they're not. They happen to have this very interesting property that has made humanity advance, in fact, that I can have your same idea and that doesn't deprive you of your idea. It just makes two copies. Hmm. Whereas if I have your coffee, that doesn't make two coffees. That still leaves one coffee and some of it spilled on the floor probably.
I guess I might put it to you this way as you're a fellow academic. You teach your students lots of things in class, I presume. Do you feel the fact that you taught it to them gives you the right to tell them how to use it?
Mm-hmm. I think the ego part of me says yes, but definitely I take your point, gentlemen, and that's and that actually is something that we're going to pick up after the very short break here. You're listening to KZSU FM Stanford Hearsay Culture. We're talking with Professors Michele Boldrin and David K. Levine, authors of the book Against Intellectual Monopoly. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You've probably also memorized at this point that you have two options for making a donation if you'd like to consider making one. You can either go to kzsu.stanford.edu, the website for KZSU, and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And either way, I hope you consider it, and I certainly hope that you continue listening to Hearsay Culture and to KZSU generally. Gentlemen, why don't we dive in a little bit here with respect to the evidence that you discussed? Because as you mentioned, and as I mentioned, you spend a large portion of the book, I think appropriately, going through the evidence that's been cited in favor of intellectual property law, particularly copyright and patent, and challenging the conclusions that have been reached from the data, and pointing to your own set of evidence that would suggest that we don't need the systems at all, or certainly as currently constructed. And you say, and I think it's paraphrasing, but you ultimately say that there's no evidence that intellectual monopoly increases innovation and creation, so therefore it has no benefits. And among the evidence that you cite is the Apache server. You talk about the pornography industry. Other dynamic industries emerge in your arguments because intellectual monopoly is not present or it can be bypassed. So perhaps I'll just open up the question and say, what were the main pieces of evidence that you would cite to support your conclusion that we do not need these systems?
Well, I would actually work that one somewhat backwards, and I wouldn't entirely agree that we present evidence that contradicts other people's evidence.
Okay.
We actually came at this from a somewhat different direction. There's actually a puzzle amongst economists. The puzzle amongst economists runs something like this. The standard accepted theory seems to suggest that you must have some form of intellectual monopoly or intellectual property in order to get creation and innovation, and that these kinds of arrangements will in fact increase and encourage innovation and creation. Empirical economists, not ourselves, other empirical economists have spent quite a lot of time looking at data to see what is the impact of copyright on the production of songs and music, for example, or what is the impact of patents on inventions. And the puzzle is that they haven't really found an impact. And it's a puzzle to them because they subscribe to a theory that says that this should have happened and it didn't happen. Right? From our point of view, it's not so puzzling because our theory says it could kind of go either way, and we have to look at the data to see what happened. So we don't find their data so puzzling. There's countervailing forces, some ways in which patents would encourage innovation, other ways in which patents discourage innovation. Patents discourage innovation because the existing patents make it harder for innovators to innovate because they have to pay off all the holders of the existing monopolies. In practice, it seems to be pretty much of a wash. There doesn't seem to be that much of an impact on creation or innovation. So the real evidence is the evidence of economic studies that have systematically studied across industries and across countries and across time, right, very thoroughly and systematically to see what the impact is. The sorts of things that you're talking about is not perhaps so much evidence as illustration. So, you know, that's all a bit abstract. Somebody did some complicated statistical work and they reached this conclusion. What does it all mean? What we attempted to do in the book was to try to lay out specific industries and specific examples so people could clearly see for themselves how it is that an industry functions, how it is computer programs get written when they're not copyrighted and when they're not patented, for example.
Yeah, let me add something to that, because there is a sense in which one superficially may think that the evidence we brought about being evidence, data, contradicts other evidence. So, you know, data, when they contradict each other and they're measuring the same thing, one of the two must be a wrong measurement. So I don't think that this is the case. But if you look at the previous literature or the traditional literature, empirical literature on this matter, in some sense, I have to say, before we and a few others said, look, guys, it may go the other way around, that literature took for granted that the existence of patent and copyright were beneficial for innovation, without any doubt. The last guy we know, or I know at least, that claimed in writing before we stepped into this debate that, in fact, that may not be the case and gave some evidence that that was not the case was George Stigler, the former Chicago professor, now dead, and Nobel Prize in Economics in 1982, that in a paper written in 1956, that was the year I was born, had claimed that that was not the case, and the evidence showed that patents and monopoly did not favor innovation. It was the other way around. But practically since then, people took for granted that that was the case. So what would they do when they go out and measure the impact of intellectual property on innovation? They would do the following two things. One would be to measure if patents had value. So there's a gigantic econometric literature, very interesting how we have used it too, that goes out and measure how much a patent is worth, how much the stock market value, the share value of a company that patents this and that changes, how much that depends across industries, time, and a variety of other things. Now, it's quite clear that a patent has value. It allows you to appropriate monopoly rents, and so it would be really funny if we discovered the patents have negative value or no value at all for the company that owns them. It's an interesting literature because it allows you to learn something about rents and where monopoly profits come from and how the market values it. But it certainly doesn't prove or disprove that patents are good for innovation. It just proves that it's good to have a monopoly if you allow to have one. The second piece of literature, which is more characteristic of people doing growth theory and aggregate work and things of this kind, ask an even more subtle question that, frankly, this one I find confusing. That is, they say, let's see if the rate of innovation goes up when intellectual properties, rules are strengthened. Well, how do these people define innovation in all this literature? Where do they define innovation as number of patents? No, literally, I'm not kidding. I don't think I know a single work in that tradition. That does not do that. Every single word there, and I think we must have read, I don't know, in the hundreds, say, I'm going to go out and measure the number of patents in this industry or the other industry, in this year or the other year, in this country or the other country. And then I observe that the country X, in year T, strength patent protection, and I measured and I observed that 5 years later across industries, the number of patents taken out increased. You see, patent protection increases innovation. Excuse me. It's some famous study, I will spare you the authors, by some distinguished colleagues, that does that with British data, for example, across industries. And they look at the extent of patent protection across industry and monopoly power. And what do they find? They find that somewhere in between the middle, where monopoly power is high but not so high, there, those are the sectors in which there are more patents. And they infer from that or conclude from that that monopoly power is good for innovation. Well, I don't know, but you understand it's a self-referential literature. In that sense, I agree, what we do contradict the conclusion, but because the conclusion was not a logical conclusion of the findings that the data showed so far. The data showed so far that, one, patents have economic value, and they should because they give you monopoly profits, and two, that when you make patents more valuable and of longer length, then people take out more patents, and I agree with that, too.
It's an interesting conclusion that you reach, and certainly you draw the distinction, I think appropriately, between exacting rents and controlling how the work is used, something that we discussed a short while ago. But to push back on that a little bit, again from your perspective as authors of this book, what would you say to the basic argument that the ability to control how one's work is ultimately used, whether it be by patent, through having the right to control the use of that particularly patented invention, and obviously there are ways to build upon that patent, or whether it's things like the fair use defense, which many copyright holders feel has actually gone too far in favor of allowing different and alternate uses of an author's work. How do you respond to the argument that says my ability to control how that work is used directly impacts my ability to exact those rents and to ultimately turn a profit, or at least sustain, or at least pay back the cost of creating the invention in the first place?
So I guess I would give, there's two parts of the answer. There's no question that being given a copyright or a patent increases your ability to extract rents. The question really is to what extent you're entitled to extract rents through controlling the behavior of other people. But ultimately, the reason that we tend to sheer away from this sort of natural rights debate is it's hard to figure out what people's natural rights. Do I have the natural right to use your invention? Do you have the natural right because you invented to prevent me from using your invention? That's a complicated and difficult question to answer. We tend to look to the economics of it, and we would ask the question differently. We would ask the question, did you need those extra rents in order to be, have the incentive to create your great invention? If you were willing to create your great invention, and the amount of money that you received was adequate in compensation, then why are you entitled to more than that? So that's the question of encouraging more innovation or more creation, right? The idea being that if people are rewarded less, there will be less creation, there will be less innovation. Those people that agreed to create and agreed to innovate for the lesser compensation, apparently they were adequately compensated because they went ahead and they did it. We're not obviously advocating retroactively taking money away from people. But, you know, if you know the rules in advance, you know that you're not going to have copyright, and you go out and you write your book anyway, what then entitles you to this extra compensation?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently you didn't think it was necessary because you wrote the book. So then the argument becomes an economic argument. Do we really get a lot more creation, a lot more innovation, because we give people these extra rights?
And the evidence suggests no.
Question. What?
And the evidence suggests not. That's the part of the evidence that we think is very strong. This, we got really convinced, somewhat amusing and surprisingly, to tell you the truth. When we started looking at history and things and so on, I was completely convinced that sure, at least some relevant cases or a good proportion of the cases, we would have found a dramatic impact of introducing patents on the rate of actual innovation as measured by, you know, number of invention, growth rate of productivity of labor. These are the objective measure of invention, right? And we found very little. I remember being shocked in the music industry. We have made all this claim on music industry, the copyright doesn't really matter, mostly based on anecdote, intuition, looking at a few modern data these days, arguments such as, you know, Madonna would have seen no matter what, even if she had made over her life $5 million, she didn't need a, you know, $300 million that she got out of copyrights. So that was all logical. It was based on, say, the last 20, 30 years of observation that we had on our own life. There's this fantastic book by Franklin Scherer. He wrote once he retired, distinguished I.O. professor at MIT, and in fact, for most of his life, a strong supporter of intellectual property until he changed his mind in recent ones. Hmm. It's called Music and Notes, if I'm not incorrect. David, you have a better memory than me?
I believe it's called Musical Notes and Bank Notes.
Yeah, musical notes and bank notes. And what he does, he has an amazing data set. He essentially has a data set about classical composers from back in the 17th century all the way, anything that is currently available and recorded. And he has collected essentially what they have produced and how they made money. He's got income data. Oh, it's called actually, and I'm looking at it, it's called Quarter Notes and Bank Notes, in case some of the listeners care about it. It's by Franklin Scherer. It's Princeton University Press, I believe. So yes, this gigantic data set, and the whole book is about exploring the data set, how musicians made money. I mean, you learn a lot of interesting things. One striking interesting thing you learn is that as musical copyright was adopted across different European countries at very different points in time, its impact on the productivity of classical musicians, on their ability and their willingness to produce more music, was essentially zero, if not negative. And that's the data. That's the conclusion Scherer has. And I found it extremely surprising, I have to say, but there it is. So that's the thing that people have looked very little over time. And the reason I think people didn't look at that kind of data is because they thought the question had such an obvious answer that it wasn't worth asking.
We're talking to Professors McKelly Boldrin and David K. Levine, authors of the book Against Intellectual Monopoly on KZSU's Here's a Culture. Gentlemen, as always, time flies by, and we only have about 10 minutes left, and so I do want to ask you more specifics about your proposed solutions, and I guess I'll ask two questions. The first is, you mentioned, again, not getting rid of these systems in one stroke, and clearly that would have profound impacts on businesses and on economy generally, but of course, phasing out these systems would still have that impact, especially on businesses that have built their business model around intellectual property rights, and we see more and more companies, in fact, doing that. So I guess my question is twofold. First, how do you go about phasing out these systems without destroying without unnecessarily perhaps destroying businesses and businesses that have been successful, or is that even a concern of yours? And then secondly, do you have any view on the current proposals in Congress or the ideas that have been kicked around in terms of reforming the system? Do any of them even come close in your view to getting to these issues?
Let me start on that one. So the issue of phasing out. So when you said there are businesses that have grown up around intellectual properties as is today, and that's true. But I would emphasize the words "grown up around." That is, they didn't spring up whole cloth operating in this particular way. Over time, they gradually adjusted to this particular institution, and they adjusted their business model to it. If you phase out gradually, what one would expect to happen is that businesses that have built themselves around that particular business model will will gradually rearrange their business models to focus on different business models. So, for example, the business model of Red Hat, which is a major distributor of Linux, is a business model that's not built around copyrights and patents. It's a viable business model. They make money. IBM has a business model built around open source software as well. They have a lot of patents, but it's not built around the copyrights on software. So there are viable business models that don't involve patents and copyrights. If they are phased out, if you did it overnight, then people who had businesses built around this would obviously be in a pretty bad shape. You expect massive failures of business, all sorts of bad things would happen, and nobody would like to see that happen, and that's one of the reasons we would never propose such a thing. If it is phased out gradually, then there's an opportunity for people to adjust to other business models. So that's sort of how we see the phase-out issue. One of the convenient things about patents and copyrights is because they come with time limits, it's not so difficult to see how you can phase them out. That is, you simply start reducing the term limits until at some point they're zero. And, you know, depending on how quickly you phase them out, you can phase them out more rapidly or less rapidly. Kelly, did you want to add?
Well, let me use the analogy. I think we use it in the book, and personally I find it very convincing, and I like it a lot because it's historically very cogent. Trade tariffs. How did we adapt? How did we avoid destroying the American economy and, in fact, made it much stronger and better over the last 50 years as we cut down tariffs protection and trade protection, all kind of restriction they gave to local companies, all kind of monopoly powers by preventing foreign companies from competing with them. Well, we did it progressively. We did it slowly in a coordinate way, at a step, announcing that it would come, saying, you know, these particular tariffs will be dropped 5 years from now. Get prepared. These particular restrictions will be eliminated and phased out 7 years from now. Get prepared. You know, get to work. That's exactly the way you did it. You do it in a coordinated and rational way, but you do it in a systematic way, as David was saying before, having in mind that there is a final target at the end of that long process, right? In which is you want to abolish all tariffs and trade protection because you understand that in the long run that damaging to the people, to the economy. And that's the same way you want to sit down with copyrights and patents. I mean, I think it would be absolutely very easy to revert back to what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act has done and bring copyright protection in this country back where it was in 1998. That would be a first major step that could easily be accomplished. It would not damage much business. It would probably favor a lot of new business, allow new book publisher, new music producer come up. That's the kind of process I have in mind.
So you also asked the question about how we feel about current efforts at reform. So as it turns out, there's different kinds of reform that are currently floating around in Congress, which mm-hmm. range from reform that go the wrong direction. Congress just passed a bill that will appoint a copyright czar. I believe they actually took out the language that made copyright violation a criminal offense.
Right.
So we're actually rather opposed to legislation that further aggravates the problem, making copyright longer, stronger, and more widespread. There's a lot of proposals for reform for copyright and patents, which I think we both support. Some of them actually we support weakly because we don't think they're likely to have much effect. Those we think would be most effective. So, for example, in the case of invention, what's so-called independent invention defense, which enables you basically to go around the patent patent by reinventing the entire thing yourself. I think that would have a very beneficial impact on innovation. It would actually would have a very, very strong effect increasing innovation. We'd love to see that go through. There have been some very weak proposals in Congress in that direction that haven't gotten very far. Strong proposals haven't really come up. In the case of copyright, there have been various small but beneficial things. There was Larry Lessig's suggestion of having a one-penny renewal rate for copyrights to try to get some of these orphan works back into the public domain. That would be fantastic. It is amazing and remarkable that even such a modest proposal went exactly nowhere in Congress at all. So I guess we're not wildly optimistic about this Congress, sort of under the current circumstances, making these kinds of reforms. Ultimately, there'll have to be some form of public pressure in order to get something done.
And I guess it leads me with a last question before we sum things up in the couple minutes we have left. Can you envision a political climate that would allow for the kinds of ramping down of these rights to exist? I mean, it's as we know, and as we acknowledge, there are so many businesses that rely on these rights, that even though there may be politicians or people in government and policymaking positions that are sympathetic to ramping this down, the political will may not be there. And we're recording the show on September 30th, where there's certainly a debate raging about the political will of Congress to deal with the credit situation that we're currently facing. Can you envision a time where there is that kind of will to address these issues in the empirical way that you are?
So I'm going to answer that by referring to a senator I saw on television a couple of days ago waving a sheet of paper and denouncing the bailout agreement. And what was on the sheet of paper that he was waving and speaking of was a letter that, and with a list of signatures of economists on it. My point is a very simple one. I think that the intellectual climate matters, and it matters a great deal. I think in the current intellectual environment, it's very difficult to imagine that reform will take place, and what little reform there is have to be struggled after. Part of the goal of this research in this book is to try to change that intellectual climate, right? So when these things come before Congress, there will be letters signed by hundreds of economists and hundreds and thousands of people who have read what those hundreds of economists have written and will understand why it is that these things are a drag on our economy and will demand change.
Yeah, let me add one optimistic. I'm not very optimistic, but there is one optimistic case I can think of, and again, an analogy with the free trade. When we will start to realize that the extension of our patent protection to countries such as China and India and so on has ended up hurting us, because now they have the same capacity of innovators we have. They have the same number, or a larger number, given the population size of creators, innovators, inventors that we have. And that it would be advantageous also for us to share in those inventions, those innovation quickly, as they now want to do with ours. Then we may realize that the game of reciprocally protecting via patents our invention versus your invention, of creating this little monopoly rights over individual innovation, is actually a zero-sum game, or in fact a negative-sum game, that we have nothing left to gain from having it. And then we may step to the fore and say, ladies and gentlemen, we realize that having the trade protection and the tariffs, you know, 80 years ago was a pretty bad idea, because I couldn't buy your car that are cheaper than mine, you couldn't buy my clothes that were cheaper than yours. It might be the same for ideas. How about start talking about sharing the idea of finding business models that allows sharing, imitation, competition. That's the kind of climate I expect. But I agree with David that if we get to that economic situation, to that practical material situation, and we will get there one decade or another, we will get there not too far in the future, without the appropriate cultural background, without an understanding of the process, without the proper economic and legal theory behind it, then it would be more difficult to grasp the opportunity. When we got to the opportunity to use free trade, we had understood how beneficial free trade was, and it was very easy to push for that. So the cultural work, the kind of debate that you organize in a situation like this is very useful, exactly because of this.
The authors are Professors McKelly Boldrin and David K. Levine. The book is Against Intellectual Monopoly out of Cambridge Press. I found the book to be very convincing, and I learned a lot from it, not to mention I think it's very readable. So I certainly congratulate you on your book, gentlemen. For those that want to learn more about your work, obviously you have your book, but I also know that you're both bloggers. Where else can listeners and others find out more about what you do?
Our writing and the writing of a lot of our associates on the issue of intellectual monopoly, you can find on our blog, which is www.againstmonopoly.org. If you want to find more about our technical research and so forth, my own website, www.dasindavidkasinkitchenlevine.com, has a bunch of our technical papers and so forth, although those may be of less interest to the average reader.
I certainly invite you back onto the show to discuss these issues in the future, and I definitely thank you for what I think has been a very engaging and enlightening discussion on hearsay culture. Thank you for spending time today, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm very excited to rattle off a list of what I think are outstanding guests coming up for the fall quarter here on Hearsay Culture. And in no particular order, I'm excited to be having on Nick Carr, who is going to be having a revised edition of his book, The Big Switch. Professor Ned Snow from the University of Arkansas will be on discussing Internet policy issues and computer issues generally. Clay Shirky, the author of Here Comes Everybody. Paul Ohm will be on next week from University of Colorado Boulder, discussing ISP liability and super user issues with regard to technology. A very interesting book by Michael Gollan called Driving Innovation takes a very different view than Professors Boldrin and Levine with respect to marshaling intellectual property rights for a particular business. Professor Murrell Hildebrandt will be on the show discussing Profiling the European Citizen, a collection of essays dealing with profiling issues in the EU. David Rice, author of Geekonomics, will be on as well. Mark Bauerlein, author of the book The Dumbest Generation. I'm looking forward to talking to Andrew Luman and Professor Wendy Seltzer, two people that operate the Tor Project, the project dealing with anonymity on the Internet. Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia Law School will be on the show towards the end of the semester, as well as Professor John Palfrey of Harvard Law School, who, along with Urs Gasser, has a new book out called Born Digital. Jeff Howe, the author of the book Crowdsourcing from Wired, will also be on the show. And last but certainly not least, Bob Wallace and H.K. Melton, who have recently written the book Spy Tech about technology issues in intelligence and counterespionage. So I'm excited to have on this variety of people discussing intellectual property and or technology issues on Hearsay Culture. And you can look for these shows throughout the remainder of the year. For those that are interested in listening to the show in various formats, you can get the show, of course, through hearsayculture.com, the webpage for the show, where you can find all of the previous shows. This is show number 74, incidentally, as well as a schedule of guests. You can also find the show by going to iTunes and going to the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School's podcast webpage. You can also go to CIS's own webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And again, last but not least, you can always listen to the show live, the preferred method, on KZSU FM Stanford from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today. I look forward to talking to you next week. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more programming. Have a great day.